all right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have a packed show for you today, and we're really going to just run through it because it's so damn important. So much is at stake in the world today, and that's what this show is built around. At the back end of the show, we are going to be talking with musician Ted Sirota about a new group that he's formed in Chicago called Degenerate Artists Against Fascism. And Ted's an amazing musician. He's a jazz musician, and he's also has a dub band, a reggae dub band. And he's also someone who has always thought about the world, the future of the world, what's happening, and stood up to do what he thinks is necessary. And before that, we'll be hearing two statements from the December 19th emergency meeting at New York City's Cooper Union. That was the organizing meeting for No. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. We'll be hearing from Immortal Technique, a hip-hop artist known for his courageous political stance, and we'll be hearing part of the statement from Jeremy Scahill, founding senior editor of The Intercept, author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, and Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. But opening the show up, I'm really pleased to be welcoming to the show Naomi Oreskes. And Naomi is a professor of the history of science and affiliated professor of earth and planetary sciences at Harvard University and one of the many scientists who protested recently at the American Geophysical Union meeting in San Francisco. And that was earlier this month. Naomi, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Sure. Now, back in December, as I was saying, there was hundreds of scientists stepped out of the meeting, which actually was the largest meeting of scientists, I guess, in a long time. And they stepped out of it and they went to a rally in a park in downtown San Francisco held in support of science. And many of the scientists that were attending this gathering of Earth and space scientists, the largest in the world, many of them actually came down to be part of that rally. And you were one of the speakers of that. And I wanted to ask you, well, the first question is this. This rally was held in what people see as unprecedented, in a time of what people see as unprecedented threats to science, and in particular to climate science. What's happening here?
Well, a few things are happening. I think it's important to realize that the election of Donald Trump is not an entirely new thing from the point of view of somebody who's been following attacks on science. So in my book, Merchants of Doubt with Eric Conway, we tracked how there's been a growing effort in parts of the United States to undermine scientific results when they threaten important economic interests or when they threaten people's political worldview. And so we've seen over almost 30 years now systematic attempts to undermine science related to environmental challenges like acid rain or the ozone hole or climate change, or related to public health like the harms of tobacco. But what's frightening about this moment is, I think, two things. One is the extremity of Donald Trump and his cohorts and the kinds of people that he is now putting into positions of power in the federal government. So essentially handing over the reins of the State Department to the fossil fuel industry, that's a kind of degree of extremism that we did not see in previous administrations. But I also think it's been a wake-up call because the reality is that attacks on science have been going on for a long time, but scientists have been sort of quiet about it. I just got an email this morning from a scientist who told me how during the Bush administration he was instructed by his own supervisor not to put the words climate change into his grant proposals so that they could stay under the radar screen and not attract hostile attention from the Bush administration. But this scientist had never told that story. He had never spoken to anybody about what had happened. So these things have been going on for a while, but there's something about the extremity of the Trump position that has caused scientists to come out of the woodwork and to say, this is really troubling.
Now, you know, this is interesting because, you know, you've said that, you know, when you're talking about the attacks on science, I mean, there's attacks that are coming down on the validity of science, which is, you know, just terrible in terms of what's going to happen in the world and what's going to happen to people in terms of how people are even able to understand the smallest things in the world, let alone the larger things. But there's been actually other things, too. I was just thinking about Michael Mann, who actually spoke at the rally that you were at.
Right.
And Michael has been the victim of a serious threat on his well-being.
Correct.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, so what we've seen is essentially two different things. One is the attack on science and scientific findings, and the other is the attack on scientists. But, of course, the two are related. So what my work has been all about has been trying to understand how and trying to explain to people how folks who don't want us to act on climate change, so Rex Tillerson would be a prime example, people who have a vested economic interest in preserving the fossil fuel status quo, try to undermine the science in order to prevent people from saying this is a real problem, we need to act on it. Because if you can persuade people that the science isn't true or we're not really sure, then most people say, well, let's wait and find out some more. So that's one part of the strategy. But a second part, which is even more pernicious, is to actually attack individual scientists. Because if you can undermine the credibility and the reputation of an individual, then you persuade the American people that those individuals are untrustworthy. So what the right wing has done, the think tanks that we've studied, the fossil fuel industry, is to identify key scientists who have done important pieces of work, crucial pieces of work that demonstrate that climate change is happening, that it's real, it's caused by man, it's caused primarily by burning fossil fuels, and attack the integrity of those scientists as men, as people, as individuals. And Mike Mann is a prime case in point. He has been really, has been the subject of incredibly unprincipled and really despicable personal attacks. And then what happens is these attacks get out, they get promoted on the internet and the web page, and then crazy people pick it up, and then they send death threats. So Mike has received death threats. Catherine Hayhoe has received death threats. My friend Ben Santer. Many wonderful, good scientists who I know personally have not just had their science attacked, but they've actually had their personal identities, their personal work attacked, and their families threatened. So this is not a small thing. It's really a very ugly state of affairs.
Now, to get a little bit more into what the Trump regime actually is aiming to do, when you look at it, how dangerous would the program that Trump is advocating actually be?
Well, you know, I think we're all in the same boat that we don't really know for sure. But I don't think we want to wait and find out.
Yeah, right. Right.
And we definitely don't want to wait until it's too late. And that is on a lot of levels. So for me as a scientist, a person who has written about science and attacks on science, what I see is a landscape that is now being taken over by people who have been activists in the climate change denial movement. So we're not just talking about people who say, oh, I don't really know, I'm not sure, I'm dragging my feet. That would be bad enough at this point in time because, you know, sometimes people say to me, oh, I'm an agnostic. To be an agnostic in the face of overwhelming scientific evidence is to be in denial. So to say I'm agnostic about smoking, for example, is to deny 50 years of scientific evidence. And it's the same with climate change, only a lot of people don't get that. A lot of people know that we've proven beyond any reasonable doubt that smoking kills people in all kinds of different ways. A lot of people don't quite realize that the scientific evidence about climate change is just about as good and almost as old as the scientific evidence related to smoking. So they say, well, I'm not sure, I'm an agnostic. But that's really a form of denial. But now in the Trump administration, it's worse than that. We're not just talking about people who say, oh, I'm not sure, I'm not convinced. We are talking about the very people who have funded attacks on science, the very people who have attacked Mike Mann. So one of the people on the transition team, a man by the name of David Schneer, I always think of Snare, he's like a Trappist man. the Climate Science Legal Defense Fund, of which I'm a founding member and on the board of directors, we have been in court fighting this man because he has been involved in harassing Freedom of Information Act requests against scientists, and not just people like Mike Mann who are public and visible and who you could say, okay, Mike's a public figure, maybe, but scientists you've never even heard of, scientists who are very quiet scientists just doing their work in their laboratories, in the field, and getting FOIA requests, not because they're public figures, but as a way of harassing them, as a way of trying to prevent them from actually doing their scientific work, and as a way of intimidating the entire scientific community to send a signal that if you do speak up, if you do, or even if you work on climate change without even speaking up in public, you could be harassed.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Naomi Oreskes, and she's a professor of history, the history of science, and an affiliated professor of earth and planetary sciences at Harvard University. And we're talking about Trump and the attack on science and scientists. Now, Naomi, one of the things that you've said that there's you've said that scientists have oftentimes been reluctant to get involved in politics in terms of standing up and taking this up. I mean, there was like I said, there was this large, huge meeting of scientists. And from things I read, it seemed to be there was a mixed sort of attitude towards what was going on or what to do in the face of that. But you said that this is somehow rooted in the desire and a need that scientists actually have, which is important to keep science from becoming a tool of politics and profit. Let's talk about that a little bit. And then what do you see about the actual role of science in society today?
Well, in some ways, scientists are like anybody else. We're all grappling with what is the right response here. We know that many of the things that Donald Trump has said or said he wants to do are deeply noxious, but we're not actually quite sure how much he actually means half of what he says. So I think a lot of us are in a situation where we know we're troubled by a lot of things, but we're not sure what the right response is. So in some ways, scientists are no different from anyone else. But what is different about scientists is the way they understand their project and the way scientists think about scientific knowledge, and specifically the idea that to be objective means that you have to not become involved in politics or even any kinds of value considerations at all. And many scientists feel this way. They're afraid that if they speak up in public, if they become engaged in the political dimension of this work, that that will somehow compromise their objectivity. Now, personally, I think that is a completely incorrect understanding of how science works. And the reason I say that is because I think it's a misconstrual of what objectivity is. It's based on a very old-fashioned idea that objectivity is rooted in the character of the individual. But that's not what makes science strong. What makes science strong is the social process by which scientists vet claims. So when I go to the American Geophysical Union with those 20,000 other people, and I get up and I present data, it's not just my opinion, but I have to submit that evidence, those data, to the scrutiny of my peers. And it's that process of vetting claims through which an objective claim, or we could call it an intersubjective claim, emerges, something that a wide diversity of people can agree on, even if our politics and our personal values are very different. So if I stand up in public and go to a rally and say, we need to act on climate, we need to support Citizens Climate Lobby, or we need to support 350, I have a right to do that as an individual, and I would say in the current moment, I would say I have an obligation to do that. But when I go into the halls of AGU, I still have to subject my claims to the interrogation of my peers. And I think that distinction is a really important one for people to understand, and I think it's one that, unfortunately, we haven't really talked enough about. We haven't made it clear that the strength of science doesn't reside in the individual, but in that group vetting of claims.
Mm-hmm. Plus, it's important. You know, I think it's really, really important for people, you know, everyday people, to actually be able to look at the world from a scientific viewpoint to one degree or another. Not necessarily everyone's going to be, you know, a giant nuclear scientist or something, but they would actually be able to look at the world and understand the processes that are going on in both their own interactions with the world and in the world and the universe itself. It seems to me that's a very important part of science that demands what you've just been talking about.
Absolutely, and I think it's another reason why it's really important for scientists to get out of the lab, whether you do it by going to a rally or giving a talk to your local Lions Club or going to speak in a school. We need to get out and talk to people, because when we don't, when we just stay in our laboratories in our own little intellectual bubbles, people don't really know who we are and what we do. And so when the right wing comes along and makes accusations against someone like Mike Mann and says, oh, he's corrupt, he's just doing it for the money, or he's just doing it for the attention, look at all this television he's doing, he's becoming rich on his book sales, ha ha ha, if only. But those claims can see, when you don't know who a person is and you hear bad things said about them, it's very easy to think, oh, well, where there's smoke, there's fire. Maybe these scientists really have done something wrong. But if you know that person, or you know some other scientist, and you said, oh, yeah, well, Mike came and talked to our community group, and he's a cool guy, and it's so interesting what he's doing. Then when you hear some sort of, you know, ridiculous claim, you know, comparing him to a child molester or whatever it is, and I'm not making these things up, I mean, this is all really happening, then you say, oh, that's ridiculous, I met that guy, or I know scientists, they are just trying to figure out how the world works. And that's the other thing, too. I mean, you would not believe the number of people I have met, because I make an effort to really speak in a lot of different places. I don't just live in a liberal bubble. People who really think scientists are in this for the money. And I was like, it's hard for me not to laugh when people say, I said, look, you know, if we wanted, every scientist I know is an extremely smart person. He or she could have been a lawyer, could have been a doctor, could have been a business executive. My husband runs a $50 million program for the U.S. government. If he were doing the same thing in the private sector, he'd probably make four times the salary that he makes as a civil servant. So every scientist I know could have made a lot more money in the private sector, but we choose to do science because we love it. And I think if we got out and told people about that and talked about that more, it would help to undermine some of these really ridiculous accusations that are thrown against us.
Mm-hmm. Now, a couple more questions, and then we'll be moving on. But one of the things I wanted to ask you is related to something you said earlier, and we were talking about earlier about the science, when I raised the thing about some scientists being afraid of science becoming a tool of politics and profit. There actually are some scientists who are both influential and also very politically connected in advance, and they advance a political and economic agenda. And you, in your book, you call it free market fundamentalism. Let's talk about that a little bit, because these are people who are actively going out and, like today, who are taking up all the insane things that are being put forward by Trump and all the people around him, that there's really nothing to worry about. The only thing we have to do is just, like, full steam ahead and get that oil out of the ground and do this and do that. And you're saying that there's actually scientists that are out there and are having an impact in the world advocating this free market fundamentalism.
Right. So one of the important questions we were trying to answer in our book, Merchants of Doubt, was to understand how the whole doubt-mongering strategy worked. Like, why would the American people be persuaded? You have the National Academy of Sciences, you have every leading scientist in the world telling you that climate change is real. So why would anyone not think that that was true? And one of the things we learned was, well, these folks, the Merchants of Doubt, are very careful and strategic, and one of the things they do is they find scientists to join their project. They don't have very many. There are very, very few of them, but they don't need a lot. All they need is one or two or three scientists who are willing to get on television, go on the radio, and say, well, I'm a scientist. I disagree. And it's very easy to create the impression of a scientific debate. Because think about it. You've had experience. You turn on your television. You see a scientist from the IPCC or the National Academy of Sciences. And then next to him, there's some other guy saying, oh, there's no climate change. And so what you see is a debate. And you walk away with this impression that there's a big debate. So it's a very smart and a very effective and very pernicious strategy, because it's incredibly easy to undermine the work of literally thousands of scientists simply by getting one articulate person to argue the opposite. So we wanted to know, well, why would a scientist do that? And most people assume that the answer was money, that these people were just corrupted and bought. And there are some scientists who are corrupted and bought. Scientists are people like anybody else, and they can be corrupted. But what we found in our work, which was, I thought, more interesting and more important to understand, was the ideological drive behind it, that a huge amount of climate change denial is tied up with the ideology of limited government and free market capitalism. And the argument is essentially that if we intervene in the marketplace to, say, control fossil fuels, then it's a kind of slippery slope into communism. And what we found in our work was that many of these people seemed to really believe that. They really were afraid that regulation, environmental regulation, would be used as an excuse to expand the federal government and the government's reach into many different aspects of our lives. So these folks made common cause with the fossil fuel industry, which I think we all understand that the fossil fuel industry has a giant, literally trillion-dollar interest in continuing to burn, you know, explore, discover, and burn fossil fuels. So the people with vested economic interests made common cause with this anti-government, free-market, ideological argument. And that's what gave it money. That's what gave it power, because it linked money to ideology. Because the other part of the question we wanted to understand, well, let's say you're just an ordinary person. You don't own stock in ExxonMobil. You don't own an oil well. Why would you buy into climate change denial? Well, the right wing comes along and says, oh, this is just an excuse to expand big government and raise your taxes. Well, we all know there's a lot of people in America who don't like big government and don't like taxes. So when they hear that, they say, I don't want my taxes to be raised, and I don't want a bigger government. Therefore, I'm against doing something about climate change.
Mm-hmm. Now, that brings us to my last question, and we have about 2 minutes to answer it, so I'll be really quick. You've said that scientists are at a particular moment in time, a crossroads where you have to choose how to act. Let's end with that.
Sure. Okay. Well, if I said it already, I don't need to say it again.
No, you need to explain what you're talking about.
Well, for a lot of reasons. I mean, but the main one is that climate change is on a clock. There are a lot of problems that you could say, you know, my study needs to be cleaned up. If I wait till tomorrow, it doesn't change. The same pile of papers is there tomorrow as was there today. But the climate system isn't like that. With each passing day, we move further and further down the road into irreversible changes. We're now in a situation where we're seeing rapid loss of Arctic ice. We're seeing intensification of extreme weather events. We're seeing effects on agricultural productivity. And many of these changes are irreversible. And many scientists felt 10 or 20 years ago that it wasn't an emergency. I mean, 10 years ago, I said I didn't think that climate change was a crisis. I thought it was a problem, but not a crisis. But now I think almost everyone I know thinks it is a crisis because we've essentially run out of time. And the technological innovations that we need aren't going to happen overnight. So now we're in a crisis moment. And if the Trump administration does pull out of Paris or does pull back on a commitment, or worse yet, increases, you know, oil drilling in the Arctic, which is what Rex Tillerson has explicitly said he intends to do. I mean, so we're not making this up. I mean, he's told us. We know that that's what he wants to do. It's hard to see how we stop that, and then it's hard to see how we don't end up in a world with at least 2 degrees, if not 3 or 4 degrees of climate change, and massive, massive social and economic dislocation.
Mm-hmm. All right, Naomi, thank you very much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on
and
the show.
I'm going to stay in touch with you. This is very, very important to talk about, all right? So we'll be back
you.
In touch.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot to unfold in the next
okay.
couple of years.
Looking forward
Thanks
to it.
Thanks a lot.
All right, Naomi,
yep.
take care.
Bye. You
Bye
too.
Now.
Bye.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Naomi Oreskes, Professor of History of Science and the Affiliated Professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Harvard University, and one of the many scientists who protested at the American Geophysical Union meeting in San Francisco earlier this month. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Immortal Technique and Jeremy Scahill, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Fiona Apple with Trump's Nuts Roasting on an Open Fire, which will hopefully set the tone for the next segments. On December 19th, there was a very significant meeting that was held in New York City at the Cooper Union, and it was bringing into society in full force a new campaign, a campaign that said, no, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. And that was extremely important that this event happened. It was seen by people, hundreds of people there, a couple hundred people, more than 200 people were there, 250, I think. And then it was seen by more than 250,000 people on the internet during and afterwards. And this is extremely important, but it's something that really needs to be supported and built up and strengthened and spread. And right now I'm going to bring you a number of people spoke at this event: Andy Z, Carl Dix, and Sarah Taylor, P.Z. Myers, Fran Luck, Jeremy Scahill. And I'm going to be bringing you two of the voices of the people who spoke that night. The first will be Immortal Technique, a hip-hop artist known for his courageous political stance. So let's go to that.
I wanted to begin with a small anecdote from far away. It was during the apartheid regime in South Africa, and there was a budgetary discrepancy, right? And there's an old saying that 67% of statistics are made up on the spot, right? So I don't know how many percentages this budget was over. And a question began in the apartheid regime: why are we spending so much money on these scientific research projects? And what came to light was that they were retesting artifacts again and again because the scientists just couldn't rationalize and come to terms with the idea that the artifacts from the African people that were there in South Africa were older than the oldest artifacts that they could find from European, we're using a very nice word, settler, European forcible immigrants that came there. And I think that this point illustrates what we're dealing with now, which is the evolution of a false narrative. And nowhere is this more dangerous in the upcoming fascist regime than we see within immigration. The false narrative that is pushed again and again and again. And that's what I'm here to talk with you about today. Unfortunately, what happens is that the evolution of a false narrative comes in when the original story isn't challenged, when it's not spoken about, and it's never had its due day in court, as we say. One thing that people forget about immigrants, and especially European immigrants when they started coming to this country, is that they just didn't apply for citizenship. People also applied for whiteness. And what was the purpose of this? Well, of course, it was because if you were not designated as white, you couldn't join unions, it says here. Police department was off limits to you. The fire department, you couldn't get a loan from a bank. You were redlined, districted into a certain place. So when we talk about people that begin and come to this country and invent a bootstrap mythology of, yes, I came here and I had a lot of problems, absolutely. No one will contest that Eastern European immigrants were treated horribly, that Irish people were treated terribly, that Italian people, that Jewish people were looked down upon when they were immigrants to this country. But the reality is that we discover that many of these groups had advantages they don't even understand that they have. So much so that it becomes a question of not being able to contend with the idea that many of the people that we call quote-unquote immigrants to this country are actually indigenous people whose peoples have lived here for thousands of years. I think it's important because at a certain level, we used to make that statement. We were here for thousands of years before the creation of the United States of America, and we will be here. And that's where the saying stops. Because what if we're not here? What if the country and the other nations around us have adopted a system of polluting this planet so much to the point that it becomes unlivable? To the people that are entering this country, I always say to them, I give a small anecdote of my life. I didn't become a citizen until I was 17 years old. And what I always remember is that as I began processing my life and started taking changes, I was offered a teaching position, thanks to Carmen Perez and Harry Belafonte. And he said something to me during a conversation that he has said plenty of times, that when he spoke to Martin Luther King Jr. at a young age, that the Reverend confessed to him that he was unsure whether he was integrating his people into a burning home. And often I say that to the people that are immigrating here: we will help you with your status, we will continue that fight. Just the same way everyone here will leave re-energized, ready to go out there and stand for what's right. But my cautionary words to them are that you are now becoming a part of a nation that has only known 20 years of peace in its entire existence. Ever since it had donned the cloak of republic, it has not had continual epics of nonviolent affairs. We've been somewhere all the time. China, right? North Korea, Cambodia, Japan, Germany, all of Central America. Are we in a nation that has decided to stop war? Are we in a nation that doesn't continue to proliferate that? We welcome people into this country who are traditionally from here, and yet they are unfortunately the victims of the small writing when it comes to the American Republic. What does the future hold for these immigrants? Will they be demanded of to serve in the military to prove their loyalty to this country? What is it that truly makes a person in America when they fall out of a hole somewhere and decide they're gonna hate other people just because they happen to be in this country? What about the immigrant people who have served in the military, wars that I don't agree with, and yet deported just the same? When I speak to you about these issues, I don't speak to you as a liberal or a progressive. I speak to you as a revolutionary because I think, thank you. Because I have a long-standing belief that this system was never designed for people like me. And for those of you that are confused, oh man, you found some modicum of success in this world. Yes, but when Pharaoh brought the Hebrew people into Egypt to be his slaves and build whatever it is that needed to be built, do you think that he brought them in with the promise of, hey, do you know what? One day, little stonecutter, one of you can grow up to be Pharaoh too. That was never part of the plan, neither there nor here, ladies and gentlemen. We have to have an honest conversation about the history that this nation has endured, because without doing that, we continue perpetuating myths and lies. And without that being unchallenged by every single one of you, whether in these small conversations or in your college classes or at home, when we talk about this over the winter break, confronting fascism, confront the false history as well, ladies and gentlemen. Learn the ugly truth about the way the nation was actually founded. Realize that we're not just here because of a series of mistakes that we're reacting to, that now more than ever we need to be proactive in our response to this. And I'll describe the difference very simply before I leave. There's a water tower on top of most of the buildings in this city here in New York. If one of those water towers, God forbid, fell off and killed someone tonight, tomorrow there would be a study on water towers. You would see it all over the newspaper. People would be saying, oh, check if your water tower is safe. The water tower inspectors, there would be new people everywhere. The mayor would be on the news. But there's nothing about that tonight because it doesn't seem like some impending danger. Well, now the veil has been lifted and we see an impending danger, ladies and gentlemen. And we have no other choice but to organize. Now, I can appreciate the loving sentiments, the righteous indignation and the fury, but I also need to bring us back to reality. Ladies and gentlemen, love doesn't trump hate. Organizing trumps hate, ladies and gentlemen. So check, it goes like this. Imagine the word of God without religious groupies. Imagine the savior born in a Mexican hoopty, persecuted single mother in a modern manger. You'd crucify him again like a stranger, tears of the anger worth more than diamonds and rubies. Imagine being locked up since juvie. Imagine changing your life is still going out like Tukey. Imagine people talking shit when they never knew me. Imagine a movie that depicted the pain in your life like them kids in Afghanistan chasing a kite. For most of the world, that's what it's like. Imagine if the person you're supposed to love for the rest of your life is set to marry someone else at the end of the night. They say you fight the greatest jihad in your heart and your mind and fight the hardest when you start from behind. So I dream the impossible all the time. F*** a Masonic design, America's future is mine. Repeat that to yourself, cause if our culture's a crime, them numbers tatted on your arm aren't too far behind. They can only conquer you after they murder your mind. So rise up, motherfucker, like the sign of the times. I feel my body weakening, but my spirit is fine. Ready to go to war with devils at the drop of a dime and fight with my rebel army until the stars are aligned. Cause Nostradamus was a white man's prophet who predicated European supremacist logic, because the pilgrims and the conquistadors columns killed more innocent people than Hitler and Stalin. So I guess the fortune teller skipped an antichrist or two. Brother, give this to the OGs doing life with you and pray for the problems with the Pope's psychology so the Vatican American will offer an apology. For what? For destroying the people's liberation theology, snatching the spirit of Jesus from people in poverty, business decisions like keeping people in prison but had the opposite effect, incarcerating religion. That type of crooked politics exposed on a populace is obvious if you read the Northwood documents, but forget the compliments for what I recorded and live for revolution instead of always dying for it. Thank you very much.
All right, welcome back. That was Immortal Technique speaking at the December 19th event at Cooper Union in New York City, which was part of launching a very significant and extremely important campaign in the world today, and that is, no, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. Now we're going to hear a short excerpt from Jeremy Scahill. He's a founding senior editor of The Intercept, and he's the author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, and Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield.
And now we are stuck with this reality of Trump and Pence and the rising sort of overt nature of their fascist administration, in part because of who the Democrats are, because of what the Democratic Party stands for. The U.S. has a tradition, and it requires a waiver if someone who has been in a senior position in the military is going to be appointed to oversee a civilian agency or a military agency, and they're going to be the civilian in charge of it. But Trump is appointing general after general after general to top posts. Lieutenant General Mike Flynn, who's his national security advisor, who, by the way, does not need to be confirmed by the Senate. Lieutenant General Mike Flynn was General Stanley McChrystal's top deputy when McChrystal was the head of the elite assassination force, the Joint Special Operations Command. He was the guy that drew up the plans for the United States to, and as they put it, kill their way through Iraq and Afghanistan. This is a force that has been totally unaccountable and empowered further under the Obama administration. He also is a radical Islamophobe who truly does believe that Islam as a religion needs to be destroyed, not just people who conduct terrorist attacks and say they're doing it in the name of Islam. He wants the religion wiped out. General James Mattis, who led the siege of Fallujah when he was a commander on the ground in Iraq, he's the one that intervened and got the guys who did the Haditha massacre off the hook. He said sometimes it's just fun to shoot people, talking about killing people in Afghanistan, who he said, these people beat women and make them wear burqas. Now, I'm against beating women, and the burqa issue is a complicated one if we want to actually have a discussion on that. But last time I checked, the U.S. does not give the death penalty to people who beat their wives or people who wear burqas. And if you have the U.S. military commander basically saying, I bet those guys beat their wives, not we have evidence, we're going to take them to court, so I'm going to shoot them and it's fun, think of the message that kind of sends to the world when you have our Secretary of Defense is a guy who says it's certainly fun to shoot some people, meaning Muslim men in Afghanistan. You have General John Kelly, who is a vicious anti-immigrant, closed border advocate, who now is going to be in charge of the Department of Homeland Security. Then you have Admiral Mike Rogers, who's going to be running all of the spy operations through the DNI. And I could go on for a half hour or more about all of these guys. But I want to end by telling you about Mike Pence. I've been following Mike Pence's career for more than a decade. But he is one of the greatest holy warriors in the eyes of the radical religious right. He has been groomed for many years to be their sort of white horse running in to save the country from vicious secularism and scary atheists and gay people, and the list goes on. Mike Pence is what we call a theoconservative. He is a theological fascist, a Christian supremacist. Well, I called him a Christian jihadist, and boy, did they go nutty over that. And I'm like, you don't know what the word jihad means. Oh, I know what it means. I'm just saying, when you use it next time, how about you think about the way you're using it? But he is a Christian jihadist. I think we should use the terms that they use for everybody else, talk about them. These guys are they're the American Taliban, they're the Christian jihadists, but what they want is a country that essentially functions as a theocracy on social matters and foreign policy, and then functions as a playground for the ultra-rich and the destroyers of the environment on their domestic policies, and their social platform is straight out of the 1300s. And these guys Mike Pence and the people that put him there know what they're doing. I want to see the story of how Trump ended up getting Pence put onto him, because Trump looked like he had to like leave the room immediately. We come out, he's like, well, there's Mike Pence. I'll see you guys later. Great, great, great. That was not some friend of his. They had only met once before. I'm telling you, Pence is the Trojan horse of this election for the radical religious right. And I think that, you know, it's going to be interesting to see who plays the fascist chess game better, Trump or Pence, because Pence is a very dangerous person.
That was Jeremy Scahill, founding senior editor of The Intercept. And you can hear the full talk Jeremy gave at refusefascism.org. He was speaking at the event at Cooper Union on December 19th. No, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with Ted Sirota, so stay tuned. Welcome back. And that was something from Ted Sirota, and it is called This Is a Takeover, and it's from the album The Scientist Meets Ted Sirota's Heavy Duty Dub. Ted Sirota, welcome to the show, man.
Hey, Michael.
I got
heavyweight dub. Although Heavy Duty sounds cool too.
Oh, I thought he said heavyweight. All right, I'm sorry. Heavyweight. It's a thing. I'm dieting, right? I have to watch out. Anyway, yes, it's heavyweight dub. And basically, I wanted to let people know that you are, when I first met you, you were just a damn serious jazz musician, I imagine, and you still are. And you've also expanded. The musical world is sort of a place that you sort of reach out in a lot of different directions. And when I discovered you're getting into dub and reggae, and I thought, damn, man, this cat is like doing some stuff. And I played some of your songs over the course of a couple of years, and I was really glad to be able to talk to you again, man. So it's cool having you on.
Yeah, great to talk to you again as well.
Yeah.
Thank you for playing the music.
Sure. Well, and we'll play a whole hell of a lot more. Maybe have you on to talk just about your music sometime soon in the future. You recently founded a group, though, called Degenerate Artists Against Fascism. First, what is it, and why did you start it?
Well, maybe I'll start with the second part of the question. And, I mean, I've pretty much been an activist, I would say, you know, my adult life, trying to take a principled stand against oppression wherever I see it, and work that into my art and my music, you know, in ways to make it most effective. But, you know, just following along what's been happening lately, I just saw a lot of grief and anguish and fear and sadness and leading to a lot of inactivity. And I just felt like, as an artist, someone who's kind of stuck my neck out there a little bit at times, that I don't see anyone organizing the artists, at least online, where people are, social media and stuff like that. So I decided to just start up a group called the Degenerate Artists Against Fascism. And that was about 2 weeks ago, just as like a secret Facebook group to get it off the ground. And we're now up to, it's about 1,500, 2,000 people sort of active or following along with it. And we're seeing people wanting to join like constantly. So, you know, we took this idea of degenerate art in Germany when the Nazis came to power. By 1937, you know, Hitler had pretty much laid out, you know, exactly who, what artists and people he wanted to go after and what types. And so they wasted no time once they consolidated power, stealing and destroying artwork from museums of all the great painters, you know, that time, expressionists, cubists, anybody doing modern art, even impressionism, anything that didn't fit the Aryan mold was attacked verbally, physically, in every sort of way. And then the artists were attacked as well. So many of them had to go into exile, underground, be sheltered by friendly neighbors, or, you know, if they were Jewish or communist and they weren't able to get out, they, you know, a lot of those people died in the camps. So, you know, a lot of people think of art maybe and music as something that's a side note to your life. But, you know, the artists that create it and the people in power, they know how powerful art and culture is and how much the masses of people need art to help inspire and strengthen them. And that's why they attack artists. And we can already see that with Trump before he even got into office. So that was kind of a long answer. I hope I answered your question.
Sure. And actually, it touched on a bunch of other questions I was going to have. So it's going to be interesting. You know, this concept of degenerate artists, you know, there's a lot packed into that. And you, I read something where you talked a lot about that, what you learned, what you saw as the lessons from Germany. I was also wondering, though, in terms of its impact on people, you know, the way, when you're talking about the way they attack art, it was very interesting to me because, did you ever see the play Bent?
No.
It's about these people in the Weimar Republic, and as the Weimar Republic, which was declared, you know, one of the most liberal regimes in the history of, the capitalist era and all this stuff. And it was like a whole big thing of the spreading of democracy in Germany after World War I and all this. And basically, it also is something that you know, in that mix, Hitler came out. And it was very heavy, the way that he went after all of these artists and really did something that was, you know, I mean, all the things that you're talking about that were done to people. And it had not just the thing of suppressing these artists, but actually, and this is extremely important, you started to point to this, the impact on people in terms of people's ability to even dream of something different.
Right.
So I want to know what you think of that.
I think you're right.
Oh, good.
Yeah, you know, I read something, I'm not an expert on degenerate art. We brought people in who, like, you know, are basically, mm-hmm. have done got their degrees in it and stuff like that. But I'm always trying to learn. So just the other day I read in an article that Goebbels actually really liked expressionism, and that was in line to become one of the official arts of Nazi Germany, but Hitler despised it, and he just shot that down. And then the next thing you know, artists that Goebbels personally, I guess, liked their art, he was in charge of destroying it, you know, destroying their life. So mm-hmm. that told me that when you have fascism, and, you know, people made Hitler out to this buffoon and this comical figure, but when he consolidated power, he was in charge, you know, and he did make these decisions. And we can see that kind of well, I don't even want to call it irrationality, but just that characteristic, I would say, in Trump, you know, where if one of his advisor says, I like this, I like that, and then he pits them against one another, and then he decides what he's going to do. So the point is, once they consolidate the power, it's going to be a lot easier for him to, you know, it's going to be easier for them to ram it through, and it's going to be harder for us to resist at that point. So I think that's one of the main lessons that we can learn from, you know, the Weimar Republic and Nazi Germany.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things, too, that's really striking, and you were speaking to this, is I just feel it's always important to really, people that really understand this, is that there is, in a lot of art, there is the aim, whether it's conscious or not conscious, there's the effect of people actually, you know, people internalizing this stuff and actually having to think about it, and it changes something in your thinking, and it changes something in the way that you look at the world. When you get something that really strikes you, whether it's a song, whether it's a painting, whether it's whatever, you know, you just, you know, there's something that it does to people, and in a societal way too. It actually, you know, think about the stuff that came up in the 60s that really framed a lot of, you know, for people my age, that really framed a lot of what we thought, helped to actually establish and push us forward in a direction that was definitely against a different direction than the whole society was going under Nixon and Johnson and all these people. But it was really something that turned us in a way. The art actually fed us. It fed our brains all the way, as the airplanes did.
Right. You know, and I think that's a lot of artists, I think, feel like there's either political art, quote unquote, or there's not, you know. So over the years, I've debated with a lot of people, and this idea of sort of arts for art's sake, and, you know, what role does art play in connection to the masses of people or revolutionary movements and things like that. And I think what you're hitting at and what the degenerate art showed us in Nazi Germany is not just the art or songs or, you know, that is explicitly putting a message out there, anti-establishment or revolutionary message. It's just like what you're saying, the cubism or expressionism, it's opening up people's minds, opening up the doorways, pathways in your mind, and being able to see outside of norm. I mean, where would we be as a human race if we didn't have that kind of imagination as you know, humans? Mm-hmm. And we can see that you can feel it all around you, that suffocating, they're trying to smother us, you know, and stomp out this, mm-hmm. this rising kind of Christian fascist ideology that's in the highest offices of government now. I just don't want to wait to see, and I think there's millions of others of us that don't want to wait to see either.
Yeah, in fact, humanity cannot wait and see, because that's going to be a very bad scene. There you go. Yeah. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, too, is just what you were just talking about. You know, some people think that there's a stretch between talking about, you know, even raising a comparison with Nazi Germany. They talk about, well, some, you know, yeah, there's a little, but it's stretching things a little. They can't look, this in this country, there's safeguards. It can be repressive, but not Hitlerian. So don't get historical on me.
Right. I mean, I personally, I've just met so many people even in the past month and even this week who are connected personally to, you know, Nazi Germany, either through being persecuted or lived in Germany, you know, and also reading articles. And I tend to follow the people that were there, and not follow, but listen to what they had to say, because they have the hindsight to see how it crept upon the society and how people didn't notice it and didn't speak up and didn't say anything. And they're the ones that can see it happening now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, among other people, those people that have the experience of living under that, and a lot of them have been very outspoken.
Right. You know, back when we first met so many years ago, you were just a babe. When we first met, I remember talking with you nights, you know, in this house you had outside of Boston, and the musicians you were into people, Max Roach, Ed Blackwell, Ornette Coleman, Charlie Hayden, Monk, you know, all these people. And then you also had a breadth of vision, too, with Fela Kuti, Marley, all these different forms of music. This kind of, you know, it was really intriguing to me at the time, and even more so now, because I have a similar expansive view around this and listen to all kinds of music. But for me, it's also, as an artist, you know, for you, it's sort of that music actually does help people, help shape people's view of the world, but it also, for the artist, it helps to, you know, you to engage with the world, which is what you've been saying, and especially in times like this. So let's talk a little bit more specifically, how have artists responded to this, and what is it that people are planning, you know, talking about doing? What are they looking at? How are they responding to this, and what are they looking at doing as part of it?
Well, I mean, I don't think I can really answer that question, but I know what you're getting at. And what's happening with our group a little bit is, I think on two levels, we're trying to spread this message and as quickly as possible. But on one level, sort of the well-known figures, people that have a large reach in through social media. And basically, I mean, this is all based around some points of unity. And I would say the main point of unity is like from the call at refusefascism.org, that in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept fascist America. So that we have to resist now, and we have to try to stop it. So there's other artists, plenty of them, or most of them, that may not agree with that outlook, but nobody's preventing them from resisting in whatever way possible that they wanted. But I was trying to bring together more artists that kind of see the world for what it is at this moment, and how are we going to act and organize and create. So, for instance, on a local level here, we had a jazz singer who joined, and she booked a gig at a local club and talked to the owners about it, who were very supportive of it, actually. It's kind of a progressive venue to begin with. But she turned her New Year's Day jazz gig into, she called it Say Yes to No. So they're putting out, linking it up with refusefascism.org, and all the proceeds from the door are going to be donated, you know, to Refuse Fascism. So that's like on a local level. People are starting to come up with these things, ways of turning their gigs, their art showings, their poetry slams. So what we're trying to create is, we're actually calling for a week of degenerate art on January 8th through 15th, where we want to see an explosion of this, an outpouring of resistance through artwork and music and, you know, every form of art all throughout the United States and even in the world. So we're just trying to pump that out there and provide an outlet, a gathering place for people, artists who are looking for this and want to act and want to do something, and they're coming to us. In fact, one person who joined the artist group started writing poems almost on a daily basis and submitting them to the group, and then I'm sharing them on our Facebook page, which is Degenerate Artists Against Fascism on Facebook. He actually, we had another artist in the group who read one of his poems and said, hey, I'd love to put music to this. So there are two people that never have met but are meeting through this, you know, organizing here, and then there's going to be creative, really great artwork coming out of it. So I'm just really trying to do my part as a spark to help ignite other people and unleash the creativity, because people come up with stuff that I can't even dream up. You know, I'm amazed at the ideas that I see people come up with. I just want to help facilitate that and organize it so that we direct it at where it needs to be directed, mm-hmm. you know, and direct it for who it needs to be for and who it needs to be against, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
So,
one final question, brother. How can people find out more about Degenerate Artists Against Fascism?
Well, go on the Facebook. If you just type in hashtag Degenerate Artists, you'll find us. We have a closed group as well. If you want to get into organizing wherever you're at, we're going to be taking part in the New Year's Festival of No. We're asking for musicians to get impromptu marching bands together at all the Trump Tower locations across the world. We're going to be doing that here in Chicago. And I should add that I was on my way to, we're protesting Pence right here. I'm sitting in the car around the corner, but there's a bunch of people out here in Chicago and trying to shut down Pence, who's having a fundraising lunch here. But, and on Twitter, we're at DGen Art, and you can email us at dgenartist@gmail.com.
All right, and we'll put that all up on our website so people will be able to find that as well. All right, Ted, thank you very much for joining us today.
All right, Michael, thanks. Take care.
Yeah, and we need to get together and talk about your overall work sometime in the near future, all right?
All right, man.
All right,
anytime.
Man. Take care. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Ted Sirota. Ted is a musician and initiator of Degenerate Artists Against Fascism, and he's a graduate of Berklee College of Music and a veteran of Chicago's rich music scene. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. Remember to check out refusefascism.org and be on the right side of history. Now I'd like to thank my guests, Naomi Oreskes and Ted Sirota, and also Immortal Technique and Jeremy Scahill for speaking out against fascism. And I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board op for today, the amazing, always amazing Kiana Williams, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And we're going to go out now with Free Cell Block F, Tis Nazi USA from Ted Sirota's Rebel Souls. Talk to you again next week.